Welcome back. This is the Mises Academy, and our course is the American Prison State. My name is Dan D'Amico, Professor of Economics at Loyola University, and Associated Fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Tonight's lecture, while in our past sessions we've surveyed perspectives on theories of crime and punishment from sociological perspective. We've surveyed economic perspectives. We've surveyed relatively heterodox economics perspectives, mainly incentive analysis by means of the public choice tradition. And today, what I would like to do is discuss Austrian perspectives, in particular knowledge problems and calculation problems, as they relate to the topics of crime and punishment, both through history and today. Also, in keeping with the sort of interdisciplinary focus, you could think of today's lecture as sort of philosophical as opposed to sociological or economics. Arguably, those scholars working in what's called criminal justice ethics and criminal justice philosophy, or the philosophy of punishment literature, have come extremely close to the Austrian insights, especially that regarding knowledge problems, and especially that regarding the power and importance of the pricing mechanism in society. And in that debate, I would argue that Austrian perspectives bear the most relevance. Also, brief announcement to the class, since the people who attend the seminars are the most frequent attendees, just a reminder that there is no lecture next week, as I will be traveling for the Institute of Humane Studies. We will resume the week thereafter, and we have three more lectures. So no lecture on Tuesday, July 19th. But we will resume with lecture 6 on Tuesday, July 26th. So, again, today there's sort of two titles for today's lecture, which will be Austrian perspectives on crime and punishment, but also the sort of more pithy title that I've been trying to shop around a paper under is the use of knowledge in proportionate punishment, and we'll talk more about what this term proportionality means. So what I want to start off with is a brief and admittedly sort of crude historical timeline of punishment theory and practice. It's important to sort of make those distinctions, that there is at any given point in time a literature or a theoretical debate, especially in philosophy, about the appropriateness of certain types of punishment. In other words, punishment scholars, philosophers of punishment, have focused on trying to explain a broad, what's often called a rationale of punishment. It's a consistent framework from which you can understand what are appropriate crimes to be punished, what are appropriate types of punishments to be applied to those crimes, who and how will administer those punishments, and then the sort of question of magnitudes and duration of punishments. When I look at the timeline of punishment theory and practice, I see an obvious opportunity for Austrian insights. In other words, Austrians are big into revisionist history, in particular in response to what could be called Whig interpretations of history. Whig interpretations of history are when the model of social change is presumed to improve over time. So by nature of certain institutions or certain technologies or certain social phenomena occurring later in history as opposed to early in history, they're presumed to be improvements This often violates Austrian understandings of methodological individualism, because in order to get that sort of conclusion or implication out of a historical narrative, what you have to do is presume a degree of conscientious and intelligent designed choice on the part of large groups of people. In other words, saying something like, well, society used to punish people by scaffolds, and then it started punishing people by prisons, and this is just because, well, everybody woke up one day and said, well, scaffolding is really repugnant, and prisons seem more humane and scientific and rational, and they can be more discriminate in terms of calculating particular sentences, and so they would carry these forms of preferences. And then the extent to which incarceration practices are adopted in various different countries quickly over time would be like a reaffirming testament that this is a preferable institution, and that there's a conscious social choice and collective choice towards adopting it. That would be sort of a Whig interpretation, in much the same way as presuming the sort of natural flow. It's almost like a millennial history, that there's an inevitable sort of shift from one paradigm to another, and an inevitable sort of progress therein. I don't think that's right, and I think that it becomes glaringly obvious that that approach is ineffective at explaining both why and when key changes occur in criminal justice history, but also why it doesn't seem that our current trends are at all an improvement over previous ones, in particular the fact that our current prison system seems completely unsustainable, despite it being in conjunction with one of the more advanced Western liberal economies. The United States, in other words. So what this timeline here demonstrates or shows, from 17 to the 1800s, so 18th and 19th centuries, the developed world, right, predominantly centered around Great Britain and England, again, scaffolding is sort of replaced by penitentiaries. Now, there's a rhetoric, right, which fits this this Whig version of history, mainly that in response to sort of social unrest regarding the use and frequency of scaffolds, sort of public prosecution, public what could only be really described as torture, as well as corporal punishments and capital punishments, gets replaced by more systematic, more allegedly scientific, more sort of sterile and constructivist forms of incarceration. In the United States and Australia, rather than sort of replacing scaffolding, Australia is founded as a penal colony, so they don't necessarily replicate the process of scaffolding, and because it's a closed environment without the opportunity for outlawry or exilement, which had been more historically prevalent in the developed world in England prior to the 1700s, Australia doesn't have those institutional forms as recourse in its criminal justice processes, so they end up using something a lot more resembling of penitentiaries in Australia. They set up an isolated penal colony within the penal colony on Van Diemen's land, as well as sort of constraint by jailing is used more frequently, because when crime is violent, it's a their major concern of deterrence is the incapacitation effect, that because of the sorting mechanism, that it's a community of inmates, as well as not necessarily hoping for social improvement or any sort of grander visions of rehabilitation. The Australian experience just goes straight into a functional incapacitative model of incarceration. The United States, We don't start with scaffolding as much, in large part because we're so dispersed and land is so abundant that there's very little functional value in doing these sort of public displays of punishment. And so instead, small townships have jails and local sheriffs. I mean, watch something like Deadwood is pretty representative of the colonial and the Western frontier experience of crime and punishment. After that, though, circa, say, by the time we get into, again, the early 1800s, and especially by the early part of the 20th century, America replaces England as sort of the dominant player in the game of international standards for crime and punishment. And simultaneously, England and the United States are experimenting with mass incarceration models. It's not just the notion that they have a prison cell or a jail or some sort of like holding facility, but rather that the holding facilities are now uniquely designed to administer calculated punishments at the individual level. So individuals are isolated and monitored from central locations, and that these architectural blueprints are replicated, especially throughout the New World in the United States. Now, interestingly enough, by the time we get to the mid part of the 20th century, there's a much more conscious and philosophical meaning behind the practices of punishment. The history of the prison experience parallels the history of the state is the broader thesis of a lot of my work. In this subset of that history, what we should recognize is that the history of the prison parallels the history of ideas with regard to central planning. In other words, the prominence of central planning as it begins in the late part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, just as much as every country, sort of every major player in the world of the 20th century experiments with some form of massive social reengineering by means of fascism or totalitarianism, so are most advanced nations experimenting with forms of social engineering at the domestic level regarding crime, law, and order, mostly by means of adopting the model of incarceration. And so there has to be, and there is, in intellectual history, a significant body of research and writing that pays attention to justifying and explaining the need for centralized punishment and why it's legitimate. So what happens is that up until the 20th century, predominantly the model that is operating behind the production and management of criminal punishment is what's called rehabilitation. Now, the ideas behind rehabilitation, again, it's a planning scheme. The idea is that there are problems in society. Crime is one of them. In order to fix this problem, there requires some centralized social action. And that action is motivated by rehabilitation. And rehabilitation is presumed effective at removing problem individuals from society, improving the aspects of their behavior which are problematic, and then ideally reintegrating them into society so that society is sort of purging itself of these problems and then regaining more productive individuals into it. There's several centuries where rehabilitation is the dominant perspective, yet within that history, the tactics, the actual techniques of rehabilitation radically change. The even the verbiage, the title, penitentiary, invokes the rehabilitative paradigm. The idea was that by means of isolation, by means of constant monitoring, that the criminal would be penitent. You would induce a degree of penitence, that their recognition of the bad behavior that they performed in society would induce them to want to reform, and that the experience of enduring harsh prison conditions, including things like flogging, including things like time on the rack, et cetera, scaffolds, physical, corporal punishments, that would bring a realization and a recognition that the criminal is a flawed, insignificant individual relative to God and society, and that it would want the criminal would then want to improve and encourage based upon that realization and recognition as to the cost of crime. By the time you get to the mid part of the 20th century, central planners, state punishers, etc., have realized that inducing penitence is a very difficult production function to achieve. Mainly that you can whip someone a whole lot, and that doesn't necessarily make them want to be a better person. In fact, it seemed to really piss them off and sort of breed a degree of hostility and resentment, driving a more continual wedge between, say, criminal classes and legitimate citizens. So by the time you get to the 20th century, you're also seeing the rise of the social science profession and the psychology profession. And so the tactics of rehabilitation become something much more attuned to what you would think in terms of today's rehabilitation, which is everything from psychotherapy to career counseling to, like, sort of anger management, etc. However, the beginning of psychotherapy looks much more like the end of corporal punishment. Things like electroshock therapy were experimented with in the 1940s and the 1930s. Shutter Island is actually pretty accurate as far as the tactics and the underlying philosophy that was motivating it at the time. For those of you who haven't seen Shutter Island, it's basically a movie about starring Leonardo DiCaprio. It's just like his character plays basically the same role as in that new one that I didn't much like about time travel. But that's irrelevant. Anyway, so early part of the 20th century, we're still stuck in the rehabilitation paradigm, but we're doing things radically different than we used to do, all under the same sort of rehabilitation fervor. It's not until the 1970s where we get a significant challenge to the rehabilitation framework by means of this guy, Martinson, collects all of the empirical research that had been going on in the journals trying to quantify the effects of rehabilitation practices. Most of the debate at that point in time was focused on, well, which rehabilitation practice works better? Martinson finally surveys everything and realizes, well, none of them really work at all. In other words, he recognizes a strong correlation between increased spending on rehabilitation on the one hand and increased rates of recidivism. Mainly, when you get released from jail, the rate at which people get rearrested and go back to jail. So, again, we see this sort of ambiguity with regard to, it doesn't matter what philosophy you pick for punishment because the practices vary all over the place. Rehabilitation practices vary from corporal punishment whippings to, like, talking about your feelings. Now, not only that, but none of that seems to have any sort of, like, real significant effect. Hence, in the 1980s, there's sort of a perfect storm for a massive philosophical paradigm shift from the rehabilitation motivation behind criminal justice, and on to retributive justifications for punishment, where criminals are said to deserve to be punished. But we have everything from the Nothing Works research coming out. It got a lot of attention in mainstream periodicals. We also get Gary Becker's seminal article where we get a model of criminal behavior back to being rational and choice driven. So you can think of the previous history of punishment philosophy as being, hold on just one second. Sorry about that. The rehabilitation paradigm is basically a continual debate between the sort of Lacassagne and Lombroso perspectives. Is it nature or is it nurture? But both are motivated towards a rehabilitation framework. Now we get a return to the rational choice vision of crime and punishment by Becker in 1968. We get the Martinson research circa 1970. We get a Reagan administration, which is sort of appealing to get tough on crime rhetoric, mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes you're out laws. And then and amidst high crime rates. Right, so the 1970s and 80s, with crime, violent crime in major urban cities, is through the roof. So it's very shocking the juxtaposition between the Nothing Works hitting the scene, getting a lot of public attention, while at the same time people are sort of looking out their windows and realizing that crime rates are extremely high. So is ushered a retributive paradigm shift in criminal justice, or so the literature says. Since then, the way the literature that I want to talk about, people who discuss proportionate punishment, the way they describe their motivation in sort of providing this third alternative to the traditional retribution versus rehabilitation debate is that they're motivated by the contemporary prison crisis. Which is basically just the rise of mass incarceration since the 1990s. So they're arguing that the retributive model, right, a justification that criminals deserve to be punished, right, we never abandoned the technique of incarceration, right? Incarceration was originally designed to be rehabilitative. It didn't necessarily achieve that, so then we just sort of kept the same technology and moved on to a different intention with it, mainly the administration of punishment for punishment's sake. Well, the proportionality philosophers are motivated by the same empirical observations that we started our class with on week one, mainly that the practices of incarceration, the financial costs of incarceration, the inequalities inherent and engendered by incarceration all seem unsustainable and arguably unethical. And so they're recognizing this sort of failure in the philosophical literature dedicated to retribution because there's no stopping gap. So that's the bulk of the debate. In other words, most people, when they're talking about the debate over the philosophical foundations of punishment practices, they're talking about this matrix. So you've got two punishment practices, rehabilitation versus retribution, and you've got two theoretical justifications that you could possibly deploy to justify either one of those types of practices. So let's say you've got a rehabilitation paradigm in place. The argument is that there's a weak deontological case for rehabilitation. One could say, well, okay, it's mild, it has the best interests of the criminal at heart, so on and so forth. But those sort of justifications don't necessarily carry tons of fervor in broader understandings of justice. Instead, the major heavy lifting behind that argument is done on consequentialist grounds, that rehabilitation will in fact improve the behaviors of the criminals and by proxy improve society. Now, what I think is beneficial about the rehabilitation paradigm, putting the bulk of its sort of justification eggs in the consequentialist basket, is the fact that consequentialist justifications have tighter feedback, is one way to say it. You can sort of test whether or not it's right or wrong. And so in light of the Martinson data and other sort of obvious recognitions that the practices were ineffective, you get logistic changes in rehabilitation attempts, and you eventually get the elimination of the rehabilitation paradigm. The retributive case is made predominantly on deontological grounds. After rehabilitation is sort of abandoned, you get a number of punishment philosophers justifying and legitimizing retributive paradigms. HLA Hart is one of the major ones, but there's a number of philosophical writings in the 1980s especially that take this perspective. It was popular, very, very few people coming out of the tradition of Hegel in the 1960s, but extremely rare. The case for retributive punishment is that it claims to be, again, the bulk of the heavy lifting is done on deontological grounds. I don't buy it, so it's hard for me to articulate the position in a way that sounds convincing. But basically, it's something like this. If the film Castaway was not about Tom Hanks or some FedEx guy, but was instead about Hitler, that would pose a serious challenge to a rehabilitative or any sort of like forgiveness model of criminal justice. In other words, if someone as heinous and as obviously detrimental to society as Hitler were sort of alone on a desert island, now one could think of that as a punishment in and of itself. But let's presume, for argument's sake, that more like the film Island of the Blue Lagoon, Hitler kind of liked hanging out on the island. He started figuring out ways to like make pina coladas and catch fish, and decided that even if he were to be found and rescued by someone from civilization, he wouldn't want to leave. Now, as far as the functional aspects of a criminal justice system are concerned, this is accomplishing a lot of them. He's incapacitated. He can't harm anyone else. He's totally alone on a desert island. There's no hope for him to sort of like be recovered. So presumably, it should have this sort of deterrent effects for the people who are still in society. The system works. However, the sort of point of the philosophical exercise is that it's supposed to eviscerate this notion that, but it's wrong for him to be enjoying the rest of his days because of all of the sort of bad things he did, that Hitler deserves to be punished as, for the sake of some sort of like karmic balance in the universe. On consequentialist grounds, it was a weaker case. The notion that retribution, punishment for punishment's sake, would still carry deterrent effects insofar as people don't want to be punished, and secondly, incapacitative effects insofar as you use prisons in order to do the punishing. Now, again, I think that the major sort of thing here, that is there a place for restitution among the paradigms? No, it's sort of an alternative paradigm, and we'll get to that. The starting point from both of these perspectives. So I guess, well, the thing to remember here, Lucas, in response to your question as well, is that this is a very narrow intellectual endeavor. In other words, they're looking, these scholars, this debate is focused on relatively modern history and relatively Western civilizations. So the restitution paradigm, like what we're going to talk about later in this lecture as well as future lectures, is the notion that restitution is predominantly pre-rehabilitative. It's even pre the 1700s, 1800s that we put up earlier. And I think that one of the main, a lot of the intellectual flaws that come out of this perspective is because of its excessively narrow focus, is that we don't do enough international, we don't do enough long-run historical investigation. So where we were left circa the 1990s and the retributive paradigm is the notion that that there's no content in arguing for the sake that Hitler deserves to be punished. The philosophers failed to give an explanation about magnitudes of that punishment, durations of that punishment. In other words, every economist in the room should raise their hand and say, at what cost? How do we know that the philosophical reasoning is correct? Any number of epistemic challenges as to all of the certainty regarding the fact that, like, it is Hitler, you got the right person, he is responsible for all that you thought he was responsible for. All of that is sort of presumed away by this philosophical exercise. And lastly, the question is, what are the practical implications? How are you supposed to administer this form of punishment? And in particular, what ends up motivating most what becomes an entire new perspective on the philosophy of punishment, namely the proportionality standard, is that the retributive argument has no stopping point. And so, in other words, what the proportionality philosophers were responding to is again the facts of the criminal justice system that we surveyed in our first lecture, that their argument is that, well, it really is a consequence of this retributive model that has launched these policies that have led to a punishment environment wherein we have a nation of incarceration that is unsustainable and unlike any other in historical comparison or international comparison. So the proportionality principle is pretty straightforward. It's arguably a much more economic concept than the previous two purely philosophical perspectives. The proportionality principle is set up as a deontological constraint upon retribution. In other words, it's sort of a standard, a benchmark, that if you're going to punish someone, even for the sake of philosophical legitimacy, that they do in fact deserve to be punished, that you sort of have to articulate and explain and or in practice abide by these three standards. Punishment should fit the crime. In other words, there's a bit of a you know it when you see it that goes on in this literature. If you were to steal a pack of bubble gum and someone were to administer the death penalty in response, that would be disproportionate. Like crime should be treated alike. In other words, if you were to steal something of, like, say, $10 in value versus accidentally or maliciously damage something of $10 in value, that those things should be treated with relatively similar punishments, whereas unequal crimes should be treated with proportionately unequal punishment. So in other words, if you steal a pack of gum and you get slapped on the wrist, and you steal a $5 toy, if the punishment gets ratcheted up far beyond the magnitude of the value difference between those two damages, it would also be inappropriate. And lastly, there has to be a notion of equality before the law. That if there is, if I get in trouble for stealing something, and am given a 2-year prison sentence, and you are tried for the same crime but get a 20-year sentence, then that would sort of violate the standards of proportionality. Again, the rehabilitation versus retribution discussion, a lot of people argued that rehabilitation effectively limited how much punishment we had, because there was this sort of like noble intention behind the practices that they were administering, whereas the retributive model didn't have any stopping point, so the state just sort of like got ahead of itself and continuously incarcerated without explicit concern. The proportionality concept comes about as an intentioned stopping gap. And in that sense, it's set up as an optimization challenge, right? It's like, okay, so there's costs and benefits, and we don't want lots of punishment for punishment's sake, and we don't want no punishment for punishment's sake. We want the right amount, which I would argue economists of all stripes, not just Austrians, have an entire framework of analysis well suited to respond and comment on that topic. So the question still remains, well, okay, so what we end up with is a number of people writing about how much more philosophically and ethically justified a proportionality paradigm in criminal justice is compared to retribution and compared to rehabilitation, and why historically we would need that in light of today's problems and so on and so forth. Those are all interesting discussions, but the real question becomes, well, okay, how do you transition our current system from what we have to something that effectively accomplishes the proportionality standard, but also what explicit policy reforms would accomplish proportionality in general, in the abstract. So what proportionality theorists came up with is admittedly a strange, shouldn't there be a financial constraint in order to determine proportionality? In other words, you're getting ahead of us, Lucas. Yeah, that's sort of the punchline. Right. What we end up talking about is something that looks a lot like prices, and that looks a lot like knowledge and calculation problems associated with prices, and the notion that you're going to get all of the sorts of biases and problems that we talked about last week via Brian Kaplan's work on rational irrationalities. When you lack hard budget constraints. But so the practical setup of proportionality looks something like this. First and foremost, everyone who's ever been a punishment philosopher, which isn't that many people because it's a relatively modern, since the late 1700s, have people actually sort of taking a systematic approach to investigating these topics. But everybody assumes that there's a role of the state. Everyone assumes that you have to have the state do these things. Everyone presumes that that the state is this sort of effective resolution to Hobbesian jungle, that there's a social contract, so on and so forth. So the first thing that you really need to do in order to get tractable proportionality out of your criminal justice system is to ordinally rank all crimes by their severity. Right? So again, the notion of ordinal ranking is language that's used in this literature. Right? So anyone who's been to sort of Mises University should their ears should pick up that the Austrian distinctions between cardinal and ordinal utility. They're trying their best to not violate those meaningful concepts. They're trying to to come up with cardinal magnitudes of punishment given a presumed punishment apparatus by recognizing the inherent subjectivism in interpersonal behavior. So this guy Davis, 1983, and these two authors, Von Hirsch and Gerborg, they're really the most sort of hands-on and practical predictors of implementing proportionate punishment schemes. So they recommend that first we think in terms of ordinal ranking of crimes. So we would start with something like systematic murder or serial killing, and then go all the way down to sort of petty theft or lewd and lascivious behavior or something. That's actually not difficult to do. In fact, survey anthropologists have tried traveling in different cultural locations around the world over time and found that according to both historical records and their sort of observed survey, generally people sort of agree that, like, if you gave index cards with different crimes on them, which had sort of obviously different proportionate magnitudes of severity, and you gave the same 20 cards but shuffled about to bunches of different people in these different cultures and different times and different places, you would get a very similar ordinal ranking of the severity of those crimes from each of them. Similarly, you would need an ordinal ranking list of all of the punishments by their severity. So, like, all the way at the most severe would be sort of a death penalty, and at its least severe would be petty fines or social sanctioning or shunning or ostracism. Again, it's not difficult to get commonality across cultures, times, and places on ordinal rankings of punishments. The tricky part is taking those two lists and sort of fitting them together in order to get more cardinal values, more explicit prices associated to crime. On that, these guys sort of punt. They use this word anchor. They literally mean sort of taking these categories of crime and, like, fitting them. In other words, a lot of what the cardinal calculative standard would require is some fixed understanding as to what type of punishment you're using. So, in other words, it's like, okay, people would say systematically and consistently that that incarceration is a more severe penalty than is financial being fined. So you have to delineate some sort of meaningful line on your ordinal list of crimes to say, okay, well, these sort of things will be termed punishable by incarceration, and these other things will be termed punishable by fine. Once you're in that category, coming up with the cardinal magnitudes of either the fine or the time spent in prison is a matter of sort of subjective interpretation within the set. So you want anchoring within these loose categories, and yeah, you might get case-to-case problems, but in general, you're never going to have it so that you get executed for a speeding fine and or completely let off for murder. The thing I like about the proportionality philosophers is that they admit to the challenges that subjective interpretation pose on the complex problem of crime and punishment. And two, they end up appreciating price mechanisms. So Davis, for example, Hirsch and Gerborg, they just sort of stop here. They're like, okay, so we would have this anchoring system, and you would need committees and technocrats to adjudicate how we would do this in particular locations. Davis has it's a hypothetical construct. He says, let us imagine the price a criminal would be willing to pay to get a license in committing the crime that he is enacting. And so his argument is much even though what they're sort of inherently describing with these ordinal matching processes is a price scheme, right? In much the same way as when we describe price theory in an Austrian framework, we imagine sort of demanders and suppliers ordinally ranking their preferences and then coming to agreements about mutual gains from trade. These guys are implicitly doing the same thing. Davis is more explicit. He's like, yes, this is precisely what prices do. And so what we should do in order to design and calculate criminal punishments is imagine that criminals are paying for licenses to commit crime in a sort of open auction. If you could get a realistic vision of what their subjective value achieved and enjoyed by their crime, then you would know better how to administer a punishment that would deter them from that enjoyment, and you would know a degree of magnitude that you can apply to it. Well, the obvious, the explicit way in which these proposals get implemented in society, since the 1970s in the United States, just about every state in the Union has adopted some form of what's called criminal sentencing reform, criminal sentencing guidelines, or guidelines often are just sort of like annotated listings that proportionality is important and that judges should strive to meet the standards of proportionality as listed on the previous slides. What you're looking at here is a criminal sentencing grid, basically, which the horizontal axes are usually the frequency with which the criminal has committed that crime, and the vertical represent the severity of types of crimes. So various different states have implemented different particular sentencing grids. Some places have sentencing commissions instead of grids. Commissions were initially established in order to establish grids, but in some cases they just never really got around to doing it. They've had all these meetings and discussions, and they've been designing their ordinal lists, but never to get a sort of consistent majority. But you can see that, like, what these grids are doing in effect is exactly what we were just talking about. They're delineating types and categories of crime, and then articulating cardinal magnitudes within those regions. They're literally like Richter scales of criminal behavior. You committed, Minnesota's is pretty much the easiest to interpret. If you've committed a theft between the ranges of $250 and $2,500 of damages, and you've committed it up to four times, you go to jail for 18 to 20 years, which seems excessive, in my opinion, but it's this sort of mechanized way to accomplish calculative penalties out of the prison system. And again, just like in last lesson when we discussed the difference between rules versus discretion, this is a it's ruled. Some states have them as advisory. Some states have them as more binding constraints on judges. And so you get a degree of attempted, or you get cardinal magnitudes out of these processes. Whether or not they mean anything or whether or not they're effective is questionable. And sure enough, punishment rates continue to rise in a variety of states that have these. Some states had better responses than others. Most interestingly, though, I would say, is the fact that Michael Toner, in 1991, he writes this article where he notices that it's sort of a spurious correlation to look at these sentencing grids and attribute it to lower incarceration rates in certain states, because the real thing that's driving lower incarceration states in those states is fiscal budget sort of shortfalls, that they basically couldn't afford to build any more prisons and they couldn't afford to incarcerate that many more people. And so judges used that or recognized that when they made sentencing and were more sort of prudent with doling out sentences. So the biggest challenge, I think, with these forms of sentencing grid comes straight out of F.A. Hayek, is that the economic problem of society is this not merely a problem of how to allocate given resources, right? We can't presume to know the particular appropriate type of punishment that corresponds with the type of crime. We can't presume that the categories of criminal behavior are given, nor can we assume that the resources used to administer the forms of penalties that we come up with are fixed. In other words, what if prisons were just super, super expensive? That the whatever you use to make them and administer them and manage them was just extremely expensive. If it costs $10,000 to incarcerate someone for a year, then we would assume making a criminal sentencing grid according to that form of scarcity. If that cost quadruples, does that then mean that our appropriateness of the penalty needs to deplete? It's difficult to know. And so basically what I think Hayek's interpretation does is it takes Davis's notion of an imagined market auction for criminal offenses seriously, but it recognizes that imagined market auctions aren't real market auctions. So when Davis is basically advising judges, imagine that the criminal was bidding for his license to commit the crime. How much would he be paying for it? Now you should design a penalty that corresponds to that financial gain. That's a straight breach of interpersonal comparisons of subjective utility. And the expectation that any judge could accurately guess that is almost impossible. Which is to say that the sentencing grids, in effect, commit the same forms of fallacies that did Leontief's input-output model. They presume a degree of given and fixed price ratios as to the resources of the criminal justice system, and in much the same way as Leontief's input-output models were used in the socialist calculation debates, and with sort of disastrous results, so too arguably have criminal sentencing grids. So in other words, any central planner trying to design criminal punishments is going to suffer from a variety of forms of knowledge problems that are unanswered by the proportionality paradigm when it's administered in practice, especially by sentencing grids. Mainly, how does a central planner know how crime should be ranked to meet social preferences? How does a central planner know how punishments should be ranked to meet social preferences? Again, we said that there's a lot of patterned responses to those, so it shouldn't be impossible for him to figure that out, which could explain why we get the non-totally disastrous results that we do. This third bullet point, though, is most concerning, especially in light of the dominance of the technology that we use to punish, mainly incarceration. Basically, the central planner doesn't know where to invest marginal criminal justice resources to accomplish the best deterrence and or responsiveness to crime. Should you invest in more cops on the street? Should you invest in longer prison sentences? Should you invest in a more articulated or better structured legal system? Roe v. Wade decisions, any number of ancillary effects might bear relevance, but we don't have prices for all of those things, so central planners don't necessarily know where to invest. And if you get those things disproportionate, you would imagine that you would get the similar disproportionalities to sort of cluster and remain in the prison system. So when we have all of these different sentencing grids, which again, just here we've got like six or seven of them. Different states use different ones, and it's not to say that like sentencing grids are bad. What you would need, though, is some mechanism by which you select across them, by which you can feed back and improve them. We should have a million different sentencing grids and a million different locations and regions in that sense, and allowing of ones that work well to work well and outcompete ones that don't. That could be sort of one potential solution. So for those of you who are wedded to the sort of dehomogenization thesis, distinguishing between calculation versus knowledge problems, the calculation arguments here, I think, are also very distinct insofar as we definitely don't have markets for the capital goods of the criminal justice system. And so the consumer good, mainly like the real administration of justice and the real securing of peace and prosperity by means of the punishment apparatus, lacks all of those capital input prices. And so you don't know, again, where to allocate marginal resources. I think that what Mises's applied wisdom it would do here is mimic Kaplan and Lemaski's insights that there's going to be, when you democratize these processes as opposed to marketize them, you're going to have action without budget constraints. You don't have a hard budget constraint, so you're going to have people who are willing to sort of signal and expressively vote irrationally. The last thing that I would say I really like about the philosophical literature and the proportionality literature is that if you take it in conjunction with these Austrian insights, that there are limitations to how effective you could possibly implement these standards of philosophy in practice, you have to be more accommodating to very radical alternatives to our current criminal justice system. This is where I guess Danny's putting this up, the Ur-Nammu law code, the earliest known legal code, had money fines enumerating for victim losing various body parts, tentacles for a foot, two-third mina for a nose, etc. Every major restitution system has these what are called Vergelt systems, blood prices. And it's not so much that they are preferable to our current system. They look and sound and smell very repugnant. There's no doubt about that. But what they do express is the functionally proportionate pattern of punishments that our current philosophical literature is questing after. So when Randy Barnett writes an entire sort of paradigmatic overview of a criminal justice system governed by restitution, it has to be taken seriously in light of proportionality standards and the popularity thereof. Now, unfortunately, from there, public choice would tell us that it's unlikely to get the sorts of paradigm shifts from the status quo system because there's so many sort of social network vested interests in the system as it is right now. You've got police unions, you have wardens, you have correctional officers, you have bureaucracies sort of entrenched in the system being administered the way it is. So public choice would tell us that any, like, a massive sort of overhaul by changing paradigms at the switch of a button is nearly impossible. What we have today, instead of a full-blown form of Barnett's restitution, in light of the fact that proportionality philosophy has been very successful in the literature, is what's called restorative justice, which is more religiously motivated. It's basically restitution without money. It's restitution in terms of, like, forgiving and spiritual, like a meeting of the minds between criminals and victims. And even though a number of libertarians would probably find this unsatisfying, especially when you're asking questions like, well, how are we going to get the real property back and the real wealth back? And it doesn't really provide a significant deterrence if all you have to do is sit around and talk about your feelings about the crime. Victims and criminals have reported a high degree of appreciation and support for restorative practices. Basically, it's they take criminals and they take victims and they sit them down and they sort of discuss the conditions that led up to the crime and why and the motivations, and it's sort of a process of closure and moving on. Another sort of radical repeal recommendation comes from John Hasnis, akin to Rothbard's recommendation, which is that criminal law is really the problem, and that much of the functionality that we're questing after in these philosophical debates is accomplished in the civil realm. So if we just didn't have the criminal realm and instead let the civil court process resolve and respond to what are ordinarily dealt with in violent terms and criminal processes, we would get a lot of the same sort of proportionality. I think that the question of how we would transition from our current criminal justice system is inherently left sort of hanging in this dialogue, but it's going to be a closer topic in our remaining lectures. In particular, I think one of the best areas where we should take insight to the implications that these philosophical literatures in conjunction with Austrian theory points towards things like restitution and points towards things like, take for example, like Robin Hanson's work, I think is interesting to think about. If we admit that we're looking for the same functionality as we get out of the price system, if that's what we say we need from our punishment system, then we should take more seriously things like open auctions, right? If everyone who was standing outside to protest the capital punishment case instead had a real viable opportunity to cast dollar votes to buy the freedom of the person who would otherwise be going up for capital punishment. And it would be much more easy to think creatively about how we could administer that to aid in victims' recompense and so on and so forth. Those things likely require some form of constitutional moment, some sort of like shocking change to our paradigm, or would be more applicable in developing world contexts than our own. In general, everyone who talks about these concepts agrees that the drug war is a huge problem, and so if we get this sort of policy reform there, and I think you would probably need that sort of policy, you would either need collapse because of the inherent inefficiencies that the drug war creates, or you would need a conscious repeal of the drug war before anything else. And lastly, I think there might be hope for some form of like constitutional amendment in the role of using imprisonment by the state, and or the use of imprisonment on sort of state-based corruption and state-based predation. So, you know, like what we would really need to motivate that form of like radical transition, though, is some form of comparable Washington consensus about, say, Austrian spontaneous order perspectives on crime and punishment. And so the remainder of the lectures are geared mostly towards what I think are the two avenues of that research project, one being responding to the compared to what question, mainly what the philosophy literature has been doing is saying that the price system is the relevant compared to what. And so what I'm hoping to build is a series of case studies that articulate historically actual examples that have looked more like those systems than our current, right? So stretching the boundaries of our narrative beyond recent history and beyond developed world. And secondly, trying to fit a consistent theory of crime and punishment that accounts well for the broader variants of punishment patterns around the world, so international contexts. So we've got about 25 minutes left for questions. We've got about 16 people in the chat. So please use the chat box as opposed to the Q&A. It's just easier. Although I'm not sure if I should have used the word fine. I'm not certain whether the money was paid to the state or the victim. Probably the latter, actually. The difference between restitution systems and compensatory systems. Compensatory systems end up being paid by the state. Restitution systems are paid by the victim, or paid to the victim. Compensatory systems are often paid to the victim by the state, but then there's fining systems which are paid by the criminal to the state. Fining systems are basically just taxes. We see it all the time. They come about with the rise of state monopoly over the criminal justice system. compensatory systems are actually really, really funny. Australia had one for a while, which basically admitted to the fact that victims deserve to be compensated for their loss, but then it also, in Australia's case, had a really strong adherence to the social contract theory. So in so far as you were victimized by a criminal action in society, society took on the liability of failing to protect you. And so the argument went that society owed you a debt. But what this created was a very extreme moral hazard problem. And so if I went to a bar and got beat up and my arm got broken, not only would the state pay my medical bills, but it would also give me compensatory damages for my pain and suffering. Well, then it became recognized that if you and I colluded to beat each other up and break each other's arms, that we would both get paid. And that happened. And the compensatory budget dried up very quickly, and then they had to change the policy programs. But it was obviously kind of a stupid system. Additional questions? Lucas, if you're looking for reading about contextualizing the restitution theory with these other paradigms, I definitely recommend looking at Randy Barnett's work, especially he has three pieces that have restitution in the title. One is the introduction, and the other the sort of core chapter of a collected volume that he edited called Assessing the Criminal. Now that's very difficult to find because it's out of print, but his individual chapters should be online on his website. Is there a way hardcore criminals could be auctioned off for research on live human bodies and disposed of as property? Mainly, could someone ever give up his right to be treated with rights? I'm sure there is a way. I mean, there's a way to do everything. Whether or not it's practical or likely is a different question. I would strongly doubt it, though. I guess, I mean, if we're imagining a functioning restitution system in our society, then the ability to coordinate wealth to make restitution payments would also be constrained by the ability to coordinate wealth in our current society. So I had this conversation with Brian Kaplan where if you make a distinction between, say, nonviolent or non-victim crime and traditional violent crime, it would appear that the system is overly punitive when you're talking about drugs or something, and underly punitive if you're talking about real violent crime. So let's say I mug you and break your leg. Well, let's say you're out of work for a week. Let's say your hospital bills are $100,000. Not to mention that you're totally freaked out by all this. You have to front the cost of the trial and so on and so forth. And so by the time I'm tried and convicted, my debt is several hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so Kaplan's saying, well, in our current world, the average criminal rarely ever coordinates that much wealth, and so it could be the case that a 10-year prison sentence associated with mugging and breaking your leg is actually under punitive relative to what it would be in a more like anarcho-capitalist society. But I think that what that line of logic, we did some blog posts back and forth on this that you can look up if you're interested. My challenge to him is that you can't really presume our current level of profitability. And in other words, we have no idea how much innate labor coordinated could possibly yield as far as profitability. And there are a few sort of really interesting case studies in what I would call market-based prison management, where you don't have a restitution system in place, but you do have massive stocks of wealth generated by prison individuals and prison communities. And so I would argue that if you have a restitution system in place where it's tied to the good incentives of getting out of prison. The more you generate, then those profits should be even higher, which I think makes sense. I know this doesn't relate directly to this, but Lucas, back to your question, I think that the biggest thing to keep in mind, though, is that when you're dealing with hardcore criminals and a wantonness on the part of victims to impose hardcore penalties, the coolest thing about, say, a anarcho-capitalist perspective is the fact that the person who takes the liability on excessive punishment is the person administering it. In our current system, we collectivize that liability, and in turn, there's no recourse if the state is excessive in the way in which it's punishing a so-called hardcore criminal. If it errors in who's a hardcore criminal, or it errors in how much it imposes a penalty on them, then everyone sort of loses a little bit, and nobody is really made to bear that sort of liability or concern. In an inter-individual system, every victim who is then administering penalties upon his criminal aggressor would be naturally constrained by the concern that he wouldn't want to be excessive, because it would then be a countersuit and liability on his own person. I know this doesn't relate directly to this lecture, but can you comment on the treatment of Bradley Manning? From what I understand about Bradley Manning is that he was partially responsible for the WikiLeaks stuff, former veteran, and sort of whistleblower on a variety of political misdeeds. I think that he's being mistreated. Again, I think that it's sort of a consequence of he's not, because of the way the Patriot Act language is worded and the federal relationship, there's almost no ability to really like appeal or preserve or protect a more standard administration of justice in his case. I actually think that in light of some of the things that Manning exposes, that incarceration could be a useful deterrent against states abusing their power in the ways described in those documents. But other than that, I mean, I don't follow Manning's case extremely closely. I know a couple people who do, and I sort of trust their opinions on it. Are you familiar with St. Anselm, Inspired Theories of Justice, which speak to the reason why we have the understanding that criminals ought to be punished for the sake of justice itself? Seems similar to the Hitler on an Island. Yeah, St. Anselm is in part one of the people alluded to in the retributive model. I guess the best response from a libertarian perspective that I would recommend on this is David Boonin's new book, The Problems of Punishment. And I don't recollect right now where St. Anselm falls on this, but my biggest concern in all of this is the reliance upon social contract theory. It seems like the bulk of the heavy lifting in all of the retributive literature is that the legitimacy falls only for the state. And this is one of, again, not to sort of like beat up on Rothbard per se, but Rothbard's chapter on proportionate retribution, all of his footnotes are dealing with H.L.A. Hart and the other retributivists. But if you read that literature, none of those guys would say that their logic, the sort of like deductive reasoning that they apply to legitimize the application of punishment to criminals for the sake of justice, none of that legitimacy carries on to individual people. All of the legitimacy is tied to a state by means of a social contract. And I don't see many of anyone really challenging that presumption. And I think that the best way to get about doing that challenge is by means of knowledge problems, because in that presumption requires a degree of specificity and calculation that I don't think is accessible from a central planning perspective. And so those logical arguments inherently lead to the forms of excessive punishment that we get. Kelsey Moan asks, to what extent do you think a restitution system should compensate for psychic costs, like recovering the cost of being scared in a robbery, as well as the cost of the money stolen? For instance, I think Walter Block in one article advocated making violent criminals play Russian roulette as a way of making them feel the fear that they inflicted. To what extent can this be justified under restitution? Well, I think what Walter does in that article is very interesting insofar as he's trying to identify a scope of imbalance between victim and criminal that's uncompensated by financial restitution. What I think he fails to recognize is the way in which these subjective interpretations of value get depleted by the bargaining process. In other words, the major thing to keep in mind here is that justification doesn't much matter. Again, I'm not a natural rights theorist. I'm not trying to sort of, from a prioristic terms, deduce precisely what particular punishments can or should be. In fact, I don't think that that project is feasible. And I think that that's what Walter is trying to do. Instead, I'm much more interested in sort of what sorts of institutions would lead to sustainable and likely levels of restitution. And instead, what you see in restitution cases is that the check, the people who you have to convince, is the judges, the juries, the observing public, so on and so forth. And in those cases, no jury or judge is going to take on the liability per se of administering fear for fear's sake. Instead, what they're trying to do is appease a customer base who wants reliable and consistent rulings that actually flow tangible, communicatable stocks of revenue. I think that's why credit card companies settle for cents on the dollar when they're in arbitration disputes, and I think that we would expect to see something comparable in criminal justice systems. And that is essentially what you see when you see things like the blood prices and the Vergeld systems that we talked about a little bit earlier. The Vergeld systems are starting points of negotiations. In other words, imagine a system wherein, according to the letter of the law, I would be entitled to cutting off your hand for stealing my car. Well, you're now induced to offer me any number of things that you value less than your hand, which is probably lots of things. In turn, I'm willing to accept anything that I value above your hand. And I don't get many tangible and explicit forms of value from getting your bloody dismembered hand. But insofar as you're saying, no, wouldn't you rather me give you $30,000 than my hand? And I'm saying, huh, yeah, I could do a lot with $30,000. I mean, one of the major sort of problems with the way in which we've judged and interpreted these criminal justice systems in the past is that we read these formal codified legal documents and we assume that that's exactly the way it played out, when in fact the frequency with which those particular practices were deployed were very, very rare. And instead, they were just sort of starting points of negotiation. And I think that that's sort of like the major, my argument is that the understanding crime and punishment over history and understanding effective responses to crime and punishment requires a degree of an understanding of spontaneous order, that these are complex social phenomenon, and that by definition, they cannot be centrally schemed or planned or deduced. That to the extent that our notions of justice more generally rest upon presumptions regarding criminal ethics and criminal justice ethics, that they are very much misguided. Are there historical similarities between the prison system reform and mental illness treatment reform because of the shift towards rehabilitation? Are these trends linked? Lots of people think they are. I do as well. I think that the subsidization of those institutions comes in American history in lockstep with the subsidization of prison institutions. Not only are they linked in historical development, but they're linked in historical sort of decline. As asylums decline, prisons grow. And I think you're right to notice that. I also think that the there's an interesting parallel with the public education system. Mainly, we abandon the moral abstract goals of accomplishing massive social improvement and social reengineering. But what we keep are the technologies and infrastructures and networks of special interests tied to those projects. So we lose the rehabilitation mode. We stop building asylums and we start building penitentiaries. I think that one of the sort of bad interpretations is that asylums were therefore better than penitentiaries, but like they were just as bad in lots of cases, so we just sort of call them different things now. The best book on that, Mariana, would be David Rothman, Discovery of the Asylum is volume one, and then Conscience and Convenience is volume two. He takes a sort of social historian perspective in that second volume, comparing orderlies and handmade sort of nurses and their sort of the social histories surrounding them, and compares them to prison wardens, people who are in charge of warehousing people, essentially, as a window into understanding those institutions better. How important is the component of practicality in the Austrian perspective of crime and punishment? I'm not sure I understand what you mean, Manjula, other than I think that Austrians recognize that in certain social institutions, a lot of them, are the consequence of human action but not of human design. And insofar as they are created by those spontaneous orders, and spontaneous order processes, that they exert a degree of functionalism. So the pricing system does not require central authority in order to function. And what it does function actually cannot be replicated by that. So, again, I think that that is a feature that is observed in the restitution systems of criminal justice that we see in history that is not replicated in our current system. So if you want to judge criminal justice systems or criminal justice paradigms, I think that economics would insist that we look at the practical outcomes in real terms of what those systems create. And then we have to ask, okay, well, knowing what we know about good versus bad institutions, given what we know about good versus bad outcomes, then the question would be how you promote quality institutions amidst bad institutional environments, and how you grow quality institutions from institutional vacuums. Lucas, I guess I was wondering how torturous a system could potentially be in a free society, knowing that restitution is still the focus. I think that it would not likely be very torturous. I think that there's a really cool book that just came out called In Praise of Flogging by Peter Moskos. Now, he's as bold as to say that we should, in our current system, stop incarcerating people. Well, start giving criminals the choice to choose from between flogging and incarceration. So if you've got a 5-year prison stay, you can instead take 12 lashes. And his argument is that obviously lots of people would take the lashes. And even though the process of flogging is repugnant and disgusting, it pales in comparison to how repugnant and disgusting is our prison system and its sort of social effects throughout society. So whether or not there would be forms of corporal punishment, the question is like, I don't think it would necessarily be recognized as corporal punishment. It's instead, what would the civil processes be that surround individual people using force to protect, defend, or retaliate their own civil disputes. I don't think that it would lead to sort of like feuds and escalating violence, and I don't think it would necessarily lead to private markets that had hyper-specialized ability to do really weird and disgusting punishment practices. Instead, the profit and competitive motive in that secondary market, I think, would be geared towards much more prudent punishment practices. And the extent to which you would have people taking like the law into their own hands would be predominantly reserved in cases of extreme, like, emotional distress, in which case our current system doesn't really do much differently than, doesn't handle much differently than how we would expect to handle them. Things like temporary insanity and the various different plea bargaining processes that we have reflect the fact that they don't serve a significant degree of danger or threat to third parties, and that's what differentiates one sentence from another. Have any economist governments tried to find supply and demand curves for different crimes and then set a fine at the price as a way to maximize income? I've actually thought of a very similar survey experiment. In other words, asking people, well, what would the appropriate prison sentence be for these various crimes, and then having them sort of like report, then asking in different form, if you presume that a year of incarceration costs a certain amount of money, right? So what should the appropriate years in prison be for rape? And then I'm sure people would sort of like make numbers up and put them down, and we would get a certain degree of variance across people and perhaps different demographic backgrounds compared to the survey results of, say, what should the appropriate prison sentence be for rape, given that it costs $25,000 a year to incarcerate someone. Same, like, similar sort of sets of findings, compare and contrast, and then perhaps even an additional survey that raises that price to, say, $75,000 a year, and see if you get significantly different results. Comparing the second and third survey would give you some degree of elasticity for the demand for incarceration. I guess... FYI, we need to finish right on time because of another's course lecture waiting in the wings. So if anyone has one last question, we have 3 minutes. Great lecture, thanks. Thank you, Lucas. Glad you enjoyed it. Again, reminder, no lecture next Tuesday, but we will pick up a week thereafter. And quiz 5 will be up shortly, and quiz 4 should be up, and I'm going to send PowerPoint 4 to Danny as soon as we leave here. Thank you again, everyone, for attending, and I hope you're enjoying the course thus far. If anyone like thinks of additional questions during the week or whatever, or is confused or just wanting to communicate insights that they're getting from the readings or the lectures, feel free to email me. I don't have that much to do, so. DanielJDamico@gmail.com. And Danny, I'm going to push stop on my end, and I assume you can handle recording from there.